Welcome, movie lovers, back for our first Anatomy of 2018, and we're talking about All the Money in the World, the John Paul Getty kidnapping story, so stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen, we have the one and only Marissa Serafini.
Hello, everyone.
And I'm Phil Svitek. And missing in action today is Dimitri Panos.
Yes.
But nonetheless, we carry on. Hopefully, we'll find him by the end, just like they found John Paul Getty, the
right,
third.
Right. Hopefully, we did with both ears.
Anyway, this movie, so much to discuss.
A lot, yeah.
We're going to try to break it down in all the various forms that we can. We're going to start with story first, because I do think the movie deserves that. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to talk about the production in all aspects, both before and after, let's call it. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, a little teaser. Kevin Spacey was recast. He was cast as John Paul Getty,
yep.
But then recast as Christopher Plummer.
Yeah.
So.
And that was really quick.
And that's not the only controversy of this movie.
No, there was a lot surrounding this film.
So much to talk about. But as we always do, before we get into all of that, overall impressions of this movie.
Okay, so I watched this film, and admittedly, I'm young. I know of Getty, but I didn't really know his personal story, because I have been to the Getty Museum, so I knew who he was, but not his family history or anything that's really happened in his life. And it was interesting to see just how authoritative he was and well-respected by his peers, and how much of a mogul he was, but not really, like, knowing his character just as a person, too. And I found that actually very interesting in how people treated him and how he treated others.
Yeah, I saw this movie in France, of all things. I just thought I'd mention that. But nonetheless, I thought it was... It's a marvel in filmmaking as we unravel how it really got made. I thought the fact that they could basically reshoot and... At least, I don't know the percentage of the movie, but let's say 30% maybe. Maybe that's high, maybe that's low. And still pull it off and make a great movie is fantastic.
Yeah.
I really love Ridley Scott. The dude is 80 years old, still going strong. This year he's made 2 movies in a single year. That's insane. Last time he did that was in 2001. Most directors make if they're lucky, right? If they're mm-hmm. lucky, they make a movie every 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
So kudos there. However, I feel for whatever reason, I thought it was interesting, and there's enough to sink my teeth into in terms of ideology, in terms of action and so forth. But there's just, I don't know how to describe it, a final element that's missing that makes it from good/great into fantastic and really memorable. And okay. I don't know what it is. I think Ridley's done some amazing movies, but whether it was what was the Denzel Washington one? I'm blanking on that. American Gangster.
Nah.
That one, same thing. Good/great, but not fantastic. And all these elements are there. And maybe as we discuss it, it'll come to me. But that's what I hope of these movies. And I thought it was great, just not fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, and we'll definitely get into it. I think the story was great. The visuals are great, and the pacing and all. The technical aspects of this film were, I think, really well done. I think it was some of the characters I didn't like that really just made me physically just irk watching this. And I think that hit me why maybe I didn't love this film. It's a good film. I didn't love it, though, and I think it was because some of the characters.
For me, I really like what Christopher Plummer brought to Getty. And in fact, I thought the most telling thing of all was when he said, I tried to write a book once. I called it How to Stay Rich. The editors tried to change it How to Become Rich, and I didn't agree with that. And once you go through the movie and you see the ending, that makes sense. By the way, forewarning as we get into this. I usually say it at the top. I guess I forgot. Got to get in my anatomy routine. It's been a while. A, spoilers. B, if you want to follow along, we have our rundown in the little description box so you can download the PDF and follow along. Also, we encourage you guys to comment as well with your thoughts and opinions. You have been doing so wonderfully. Anyway, the point being that that to me was the real story of him wanting to stay rich and the fact that he just refused to spend money unless it was for investment.
Mm-hmm. Or just personal things that he wanted.
But they were investments.
You know, and until
like
we
art found it. And all that, that's, quote, an investment. Cars could technically be an investment.
Right. I thought it was interesting, and you kind of get the sense of his mentality and how he goes about different situations and how he looks at situations and how he deals with them. I think it's a good, but it was good, but it was a very dark reflection on who he is and how he came to be so successful and financially successful.
Yeah, that's the part I wish I got a little more into his mind of him as an actual businessman. Yeah. But one of the very early on things for me that took him from just this evil, greedy, sort of one-dimensional character was when he – at first when he refuses to pay, you're like, yeah, what is – what that amount of money, what is that really to you? It's pennies. Yeah.
But then change.
But then you see all the letters from everyone just being like, we're the kidnappers. We're the kidnappers. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, I get it.
Yeah.
Okay. There's inner workings there that justify not just giving randomly money to whoever.
Right. And there was also a really good line where I think it goes along the lines of, you know, if I gave 1 cent for every grandchild that went has gone missing, I'd have 14 grandkids who are gone missing. And I'm like, oh, that's also pretty true. If he just gave money to anyone, people are just going to know that, hey, he's willing to pay. People are going to constantly steal and abduct his grandkids.
And not even just the grandkids. Kids.
Yeah. And anyone else. Just family members in general. If he gives them any ounce of, you know.
Leeway.
Leeway. Yeah. And just any money.
Yeah. So I think that to me was sort of one of the lesser themes of the movie. Like it tried to hit it, but it didn't hit it in the way that. I think the weight of it they were trying to really tell, how do you actually keep your money?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that's an interesting lesson. Maybe I'm just fascinated by myself, but the fact everyone, when I talk to people, whether lower class or middle class, it's always, how do I become rich? And you know, you can look at Mayweather, the dude on a fight makes $160 million.
I know.
But then he blows it all away in like the next 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So if you can't keep your money, what's the point?
How do you, yeah. But that makes sense from the so-called lower middle class. They're always reaching up and trying to get to the echelon tier. But when you're already there, how you maintain your status. That's the interesting thing. And I liked how we kind of got an idea of how Getty stayed financially rich. But he still didn't tell the audience exactly how he did it.
Yeah.
And I like that. And you kept that mystery within him.
Now, as far as what you talked about, not really knowing the backstory, we live in Los Angeles, and so we are blessed to have the Getty Center here. It's a wonderful place in the sense that there is a lot, it's a museum. It's got all the artwork and so forth. They've obviously commercialized it to a degree, too. There's great restaurants and mm-hmm. a great view. But overall, the museum is what people go for. My sort of entry into it, as soon as like the I didn't know any real context going into this movie. Obviously, I did not live through it, nor did you. Dimitri has.
Has.
So it's unfortunate to not have him. But nonetheless, you know, my sort of only entry point as soon as the movie opened up was, oh, I remember Getty gas stations. I grew up with a lot of Getty gas stations. I could see, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. Are they big? I'd imagine they're bigger in Europe. I mean, they are here, but not as prevalent.
They had them we had them in Connecticut. They're all over Connecticut.
Okay. See, we did not have them in the Midwest where I come from.
No offense, your town's the world's smallest town, so you didn't have a lot of things.
It's very, very true.
So, anywho. But yeah, let's, I guess, take a quick step back and give context to all of this. You want to talk about the development and kick us off that way?
Yeah, so in March, Ridley Scott was finalizing plans to direct this film with David Scarpa, who scripted it, and about this, and, you know, it was March of...
Last year, 2017. Year.
So, I mean, Ridley Scott, humongous turnaround. Like, how fast is that? And so March of 2017, that's when the ball started rolling, and it actually had a premiere at the AFI Fest, which is American Film Institution, which is, you know, known for having amazing actors, amazing directors, alumni coming from that institution.
But then it was withdrawn because of all the things that we will get into. But overall, I'm just fascinated by the fact that originally the primary budget of about $40 million obviously grows given... the context of having to do more reshoots and other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's just that. We're not talking about promotion, which basically you have to scrap your entire promotion set and go from scratch. And just like that, you ideally, you like to plan your promotion, have things be ready a couple of weeks in advance. This was all ready. And then, boom, Kevin Spacey allegations come out and you have to redo everything. And but they're finding their way. And whatnot. And it is overall based on the 1995 book titled Painfully Rich, The Outrageous Fortune and Misfortunes of the Heirs of J. Paul Getty. And, you know, it's interesting. One of the things I look sort of back on, to me, Princess Diana comes to mind, this comes to mind, and a couple of other type of stories, even like I, Tonya this year with Tonya Harding.
Mm-hmm.
Where essentially we had celebrity gossip without having the TMZs, the E! News, the Entertainment Tonights of the world.
Right.
And so imagine how big it must have been when mainstream news, not gossip news, picking up stories like this of a kidnapping worldwide.
Right. And we saw it was broadcasted on television all over newspapers. I mean, this was back in the hard copy days where... they didn't have the internet. So this was a humongous story when the whole world knew about it. I think it's fascinating because it also just shows they had to work so fast in an environment that was naturally more obsolete than it is now. It was a slower way to get the news.
It was, and obviously it's not something you prepare for at all. Especially because it didn't really exist. Like, that sort of sensationalized news at that sort of pace. And in a sense, too, one of the things I was thinking about, whether from Gail's perspective or otherwise, you know, as you're watching this stuff on TV and they're putting out information, you start to wonder, wait, is this information actually true? How do they get it? Should I know this information? Will that help my cause? Or they just, is this, quote, fake news, as we like to say in 2018.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, I mean, they didn't have... this would be the trending topic of the day or of the couple weeks that this went over. And I think it's fascinating, too, because we see the... and I don't want to call it old school, but we see how every time Gail, not to jump ahead, had to do a phone call, they were tapping her lines just to see maybe this person is the actual kidnapper. Like, so it went back to the modern day technology back in those days of how they actually tried to snuff out these kidnappers. And I think it was very authentic to the story.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed that side of it. I think that stuff to me is very fascinating because you and I have seen a lot of sci-fi, and I think they just oversimplify it. I like the actual, for lack of a better term, detective work behind all of it.
Yeah.
I know you're a big fan of Sherlock and so forth, so that's where your love for that stems from.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where mine stems from, maybe Scooby-Doo, but nonetheless.
I love Scooby-Doo, too.
There's just that where you have to less rely. I mean, part of it's, yes, you have the tools available to you, but it's more so your mind interpreting what's at play.
Yeah.
And being able to figure that out.
Yeah. And, I mean, for the characters in this film, we'll get to them, but the people that were involved and how Gail got the information from, like, side sources and, like, who does she trust? And you saw some moments where Gail was like, no, like, I don't trust you. I'm going to do this way. I think it's interesting because when you have so many imposters, who do you trust?
And one of the things, so let's start to go a little bit closer with it. As far as everything's concerned, what was interesting to me, that overall, we can say that there's three main characters. And yes, there's Chris Plummer, who plays the kidnappy. I call him the MacGuffin. I think he's a wonderful character, but ultimately he's a MacGuffin.
Oh, you mean Charlie Plummer.
Charlie,
yes. We have Christopher Plummer, Charlie Plummer, and they're not related.
Yes.
Very confusing, yes.
Yes, that's where it definitely gets confusing. But for me, the three main characters are Christopher Plummer's character, the original John Paul Getty. Then you have Gail, and then Mark Wahlberg's character.
Fletcher.
And what's interesting to me is they're both sort of going for the same goal, but in completely different ways of going about it. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, Fletcher and John Paul are sort of on the same page, and then they divert. And so when you talk about Gil's, who do I trust, who do I not trust, that's when Fletcher really starts helping her, it becomes this thing of, wait, how did this shift happen?
Right. And it makes sense that it would start with J.P. Getty and Fletcher more so working to find, you know, the younger J.P. Getty, the third, because they are both businessmen. Fletcher does have the experience of how to negotiate in situations like this. Maybe not for hostage situations, but he knows how to talk to people and talk them down from a bigger situation. So you understand the business aspect and why they paired up first. But when you bring the more humanistic element and actually, hey, these are people, this is a person's life we're dealing with, this isn't business or money or numbers, this is a person, that's where, you know, the moral compass comes in with Gail. And I like that because it brought a more humanistic element to the story compared to just a cold mogul type of story.
Yeah, and I think the three of them did overall really well. As far as, like, Fletcher's concerned, one of the traits to me that was so compelling was the fact that everyone kept asking him why he didn't have a gun. He said, listen, when you get to a certain level, you don't need a gun. Like, the type of things he does shouldn't require a gun.
Yeah. It's more about smarts than actual, you know, brawn in a way.
And that was very interesting to hear because, you know, his background was very high up in terms of the FBI and so forth. And that's why he was not a business partner of John Paul, but
he worked for him in certain business negotiations and deals and stuff. And I think Fletcher did actually, and we'll get more into his character, but his involvement with everything, he did actually a good job of negotiating from starting from $17 million. And going down, and we see throughout the movie the price just keeps going down. I'm like, okay, let's make it a more reasonable price. Instead of from 17, it went down to eventually $1 million, and that's a humongous negotiation.
Well, what it ended up being to me, and I think this is true in a lot of negotiations, probably old school, maybe less new school, it just becomes a war of attrition. Because eventually, it wasn't so much that the kidnappers wanted the $1 million. It just became such a hassle at that point that we're like, fuck it. We'll take it.
Yeah.
We'll take the $1 million. We just want to be done with this shit.
Yeah. I mean, and they kept passing off the J.P. Getty the third off to more people. It's just like, all right, now he's your problem. You deal with this whole situation. Yeah. So it just made me think, like, what was the point in all of this when you started at 17 just to be at the end of the day you don't want to deal with it anymore?
Well,
it was kind of like all for naught.
Well, that's where the war of attrition comes in, because they thought this was going to be a lot easier. It was like, okay, we kidnap him. Great. We're going to do this. We're going to get the money and be done with this in a matter of days. Not, wait, we're still into this. We're holed up in this trash place.
Yeah.
Where's my life going type of situation.
Yeah. I think they did a good job of And that was also just a very tactical move of just trying to keep J.P. Getty III alive. Like, let's keep wrangling them, or what they call haggling in that sense. Let's keep haggling just so he can live. They're not going to kill him if we keep negotiating.
Yeah. Well, that was, I guess now's as good a time as any to talk about the ear. Because they didn't kill him.
But
it was either going to be a foot, a finger, or an ear.
Yeah, that ear. It was painful to watch, but I've seen so many medical shows that I'm actually, as terrible as it sounds, I'm pretty used to it. Painful to watch. I was in the theater watching everybody else, and people were covering their eyes. So I was like, oh, all right, nasty. Terrible. I feel bad for the third, you know, JP the third.
Oof. And I mean, as gruesome as it sounds, I appreciated that they actually took the time to put that on camera, simply because, as far as history goes, that was a big turning point. Mm-hmm. It was certainly part of the marketing, but I think that's because the movie did it. And you know, you could part of it's just the frustration, as we're talking about, of the kidnappers of, okay, like, enough's enough. You guys think you guys can mess with us and get us lower. We're going to take action.
Yeah. If you keep messing with us, we're going to take more appendages from him. And it sent that message is like, hey, they're serious. They're actually disfiguring him. And it will eventually get to the point where they're just going to kill him and they're going to be tired of all this. And it was gruesome to watch. It was a big turning point in the movie because that's when Fletcher was like, oh, actually, and I think that's the point where his character actually turns. He's like, no, I just have to save this guy. It's not for money. It's not business. This is a human life.
Yeah, and I like the kidnapper, the friend, right? I'll call him the friend.
Yeah, 50.
This was a turning point for him, too, because he was becoming an ally, and then he knew he had to play along at that point. And so when he comes in, just the first line, I don't know if it's exactly the first line, but he's a good doctor. The fact he was trying to reassure him, mm-hmm. like, listen, this is going to suck, but he's capable of doing it, so just shut up and just go with it, and you'll at least live.
Oh, man. And I just felt bad for 50 because he was stuck between a rock and a hard place. And even Roman Duris, the actor himself, says, you know, I think he's a good person who's doing the wrong job. I was like, yeah, absolutely. I'm just thinking, how the heck did he even get involved in this whole affair with all these guys? And but I liked him because he was our informant, essentially, for Gale. And the more that he gave us, the more a reassurance that, hey, John Paul Getty III is good. You know, he's still alive. It's fine.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk more about Gale specifically, because I think we'd be remiss not to for a variety of reasons, but story-wise, certainly. You know, we talk about strong women characters often, and, you know, she really doesn't have control of the situation whatsoever, and yet she maintains her stability, her forthright and passion towards her goal, which is to save her kid.
Yeah.
And she's surrounded by, certainly initially, just asshole men.
Yeah.
Certainly the husband.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I felt for Gail, and I liked how they quickly established that her character was married into the family, really had no emotional connections to John Paul Getty, and she was only there because of just the marriage, not out of love, or it was more so out of obligation. And so when this all happened and she knew she had to turn to John Paul, even though she's not really connected with him, she was in it for herself. Yeah, it would help if John Paul would actually pay. But you knew she was fighting for this battle alone.
And the interactions that she did have with him, just so brutal, right? He stays true to his negotiation tactics. And when you talk about war of attrition, he had such a long play where they make the deal initially, and then essentially by the end she has to renegotiate and he gets everything he wanted back. Mm-hmm. Just so she, you know, she could get which the small crumb that she wanted.
Yeah, and it was smart of how she, I don't want to say go rogue, but again, she was fighting by herself, so she had to do things on her own, and she had to talk to people on the side on her own. And I think it was very well played because she was so, I mean, I think that's what any mother should do when your son is kidnapped. And Michelle Williams is just a freaking phenomenal actress. She can play that soft and invulnerable side, but also be strong at the same time.
Yeah, very, very fantastic job. What other story elements did you gravitate towards?
I think it was interesting of the deadbeat father. With Gail, and you can understand why Gail really did not want to be part of this Getty family. But the father, I thought he was going to play a bigger role, but it turns out he just ended up being deadbeat.
Well, he does play a large enough role overall, because certainly more than I thought, because the fact that John Paul Getty has a relationship beyond initially he writes to him and says, hey dad, I need a job. He gets a job, and then the divorce and such happens. And when I talk about the second negotiation with Gail and them, mm-hmm. he obviously plays a large part in that. And so not the most screen time, but certainly a huge impact with the screen time he did have.
Right, that's true. But also, he was just being a jerk about it. It's like, yes, let's get our son back, but if I'm going to help, I get full custody. I'm like, come on, that's what you're thinking about right now? Just be focused on getting your son back, not who gets to spend more time with him once he's back. It just showed up that like he was just a jerk. And it also, I did like the backstory history between the father and John Paul, because it showed a humanistic side of John Paul that he does have somewhat of a twisted connection to his kids and just to his family, that like on some level he actually cares, and it just gave the audience hope that hey, maybe on some level he'll actually care about his grandkids by extension.
Well, the interesting part is he cared a lot. He really did. The whole idea of his wealth is tied into this trust, which is owned by the family mm-hmm. and will be. And so he has a very strange way of showing it.
Yeah, a twisted way of showing it, yes.
Because ultimately, that to me was the irony, was that what he wanted most was a family, because that's who he was giving everything to. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he needs to read a book because he didn't go about it the right way.
Yeah, very true. Very true.
As far as loving the grandkids, I mean, I think they did a good job of establishing that early on that, hey, he at least liked his grandkids.
Yeah.
And wanted them to do well and sort of carry on the legacy. Very interesting. So let's talk about it. Not explicitly stated, but he gets the statue, right? He gives it away as a gift to his grandson, tells him the value, which is completely false. What's the lesson?
Well, I think the lesson was, and I think just how they established it was, he cares about his grandkids, but get to the level where you can give away gifts doesn't depend on money. The like items and memories are priceless, in essentially. But also, he lied at the same time. When we find out near the end, there it was just a trinket. But I think it establishes the fact that yeah, I can give you something that can give you happiness, but happiness is also priceless.
And I was thinking a lot of it had to do with perception, especially when it came, because the whole collection was art. So I think he taught him, yes, it was a lie, but I think part of that is just perception. Like, if he ever goes to sell that art, hey, this is a one-of-a-kind Van Gogh. Mm-hmm. perceived value, actual value might be $20 worth of paint, but we're going to sell it for $57 million.
Yeah.
Whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so it's just being able to how to negotiate a deal worth of, you know, basically just selling useless junk.
Yeah. And I think it was also just a slight foreshadowing of, hey, if he has just one statue that's like a hand-sized statue that's worth one point whatever million, how many other things that are so much bigger are worth probably more that he actually has stored away, yeah, which we find out at the end. I'm like, all right, that it was a good tie into the end.
Absolutely. And by the way, I didn't mean to call art crap, but you get my my idea. Anyway, all right. So I guess let's sort of talk about how they finally the sort of murder mystery of it all, even though murder doesn't actually take place. I thought overall pretty suspenseful when they're finally all coming in. And they know the location.
Yeah.
They got to get him. And he's just... The grandson is just riding out in the streets. And I thought that was very fascinating because we've seen the other characters for so long. And then when he... You know, when Fletcher sees him and he's like, get away from me, dude. Right? And yeah, it was a nice moment of like, oh yeah, he doesn't know you.
He doesn't know him. I think it was really good. Very beautifully well shot. And we'll get into production later. But I think this helped build with just the editing and the pacing when everyone finally meets in the same location. Because it was like a cat and mouse type of game within this, and who knows who trusts who. And it once they finally met up and Fletcher finally finds the son, it's like everyone had that sigh of relief, like, okay, he's good, and we found him, now run. I liked it. I think it was a great scene. Not really action, but very suspenseful.
Yeah, they played it a lot slower, which I thought worked very well. It reminded me of Zero Dark Thirty. Just very methodical. Mm-hmm. The action is really in the inaction of just trying to figure out everything, what's what, the location, the people, as you said, and all that.
Yes, let's storm the location. Let's get out.
And the embrace, when finally the grandson and Gail see each other, mm-hmm, that was just, I'm surprised more people didn't get up and just clap.
Oh, I think I might have, if I remember. I was like, oh, finally, she sees him. I think it was a well-earned moment because Gail's been looking for him the whole time. And when you see a mother reunite with a kidnapped son, it's a great, happy moment.
And to that point, for as far as the grandson's concerned, the fact that he survived is a huge testament.
Mm-hmm.
Because in some sense, you could look at like, oh, spoiled rich kid type of mentality, but he wasn't. And I think, you know, anyone to survive in that scenario is a strong person.
Right. And you knew that the John Paul Getty III had his wits too, starting the fire to try to escape. I thought that was really smart. Yeah, and he used his own resources to start the fire. And so you knew on some level that he had intelligence of survival. And I thought that was cool. It's like, okay, the reason why he survived is like he also was looking out for himself. And I liked it because after the whole starting the fire and running away, even though he got caught and back into their hands, I thought that was very intelligent, and I wasn't expecting it because I didn't know a lot about Getty III. I didn't know he was innovative and resourceful.
Yeah, he did a good job overall. All right, well, story wise, I think we touched on most of it. I mean, I'm sure we'll hit other touch points as we talk about other stuff. But is there anything that you're dying to talk about story wise before we move on to the rest of the aspects of the movie?
No, I think we covered it.
All right. Well, as always, we encourage you fans as well, if there's something that you felt we needed to go a little bit deeper on or we didn't touch upon, write in the comment section. We'll read it. We'll respond. All that fun stuff. The conversation mm-hmm. begins with us, but it does not end with us. Very there true. Is the difference. All right. Where to begin? So much to talk about. I guess let's start with let's start with overall production.
Yes.
All the Money in the World began its original production back in May 31st of 2017. Principal photography had begun. They were shooting it. And all in all, Kevin Spacey's role took about 10 days to film.
Yeah.
Now, that's not the whole movie, but his role took 10 days. And then, obviously, the other stuff. And Ridley Scott is just... I mean, that's a very fast turnaround.
That's a crazy turnaround because if you remember, Alien Covenant only came out like in May. That month or like 1 month before that. So he's a busy guy. I think it's brilliant. And the locations that they got for the shot were fantastic to look. I love the color palette of everything. We had the bright golden rich hues of Getty's Mansion. Especially, there was a moment, not to jump ahead, but like at the end of the film where he's next to the fire, you just, there had that luxurious look of his life that he's so rich. This is what his mansion looks like. It was gorgeous. I love the color palette for everybody. And when we saw Gail in her house, it was more bluish, more saturated, darker kind of, because she's not as rich. You can definitely see the different locations that really added to the characters.
Yeah. A quick side note, I did appreciate that when he's dying, the way he tells everybody that he's dying is he basically steals his artwork to set off the alarm,
mm-hmm.
which was smart. Talk about ingenuity.
Yeah.
Anyway, and as it, Kevin Spacey, they originally wanted him, they cast him, but a lot of prosthetics. Getty at the time was about 80 when this happened. And Kevin Spacey is only 56, so a huge difference in age. I mean, that's almost, well, that's 24 years, yeah. almost 25. So that's, and especially when you get towards that side of things, no offense, that's a huge gap. It's not like, you know, the difference between 20 and even 50.
Right. And the only time I knew really about the promotion for this film was when I saw the trailer. That had the original cut trailer that had Kevin Spacey in it because it was a big reveal. They only saw like back or side shots of Getty, and then literally the last seconds of the trailer is like, and Kevin Spacey as John Paul Getty, and you see the reveal of his face, and you're like, oh, prosthetics upon prosthetics. It's actually distracting.
It is. It didn't look right.
No, it's just like if you're gonna play an 80-year-old character. Get an 80-year-old character actor. There are so many good ones out there.
Yeah, and as far as Christopher Plummer, I mean, it's not like he's not new to the game.
No, he's a veteran actor.
Sound of Music being like obviously. A classic movie among his other works.
Accolades. Yeah. I mean, and I think that's also what we have issues with just casting in general. Sometimes they just cast people for business or for a name to get butts in the seats compared to this is an opportunity for someone who actually has the talent to play this character.
Yeah, and so I don't want to go too far into it and give all the details. You guys can read about it in the various trade papers at this point, but Kevin mm-hmm. Spacey, and you know, unfortunately accused as part of this the whole Me Too movement and so forth. And so unanimously they vote, we got to reshoot this guy.
Yeah.
We got to take him out of the movie and we got to reshoot him, which unprecedented in the history of, I mean, it's happened before they've taken out actors, but in that fast amount of time when their deadline is they got to release this movie in a couple weeks. You got to promote the movie too.
Right. And redo everything. Shots, re-edit, re-sound, everything like to a techno. They were refilming on Thanksgiving, which was only a month and a half ago. Can you believe that? So I think it's just crazy that, and amazing, I mean, kudos to Ridley, that they were able to pull it off. And Ridley had the wherewithal that very day that the allegations came out against Kevin Spacey. Ridley was like, crap, I cannot have him in our film. He got on the ball fast, and that very night he had a meeting with Christopher Plummer, and Christopher Plummer was on board. But also, people may not know that Patty Jenkins was actually helped in the involvement with recasting. Hmm. She because the
director of Wonder Woman.
Yes, the Wonder Woman. But because of, you know, how fast news travels, especially after this, had the information gotten out that they were recasting Kevin Spacey, it would have killed the film already, just the information alone. So it was very secretive. Patty Jenkins got involved with the casting, and she sent out like a very vague description looking for an 80-year-old actor. Mm-hmm. And then that's how Christopher Plummer got involved. And then that night, they had their meeting, and Christopher Plummer was now recasted.
Well, Ridley Scott always, he says now he always wanted Christopher Plummer, although there's, the truth is a little skewed because he said, like, Kevin Spacey's perfect for the role at the time that Kevin Spacey was mm-hmm. the role now. You know, it's a little bit of hindsight and whatnot. But yeah, they just for me, the gumption and confidence to say, I can do it. Because, mm-hmm. yeah, okay, I get it. It's the right thing to do, maybe, or you kind of realize we're screwed if we put this movie out with Kevin Spacey. But to not hit any sort of panic button, that's a whole different story.
Well, they talk about redlining and just rolling up your sleeves. He did it. I mean, good Lord. And the guy's 80. That's just an amazing feat in and of itself. But also, with the whole recasting, Ridley Scott also had to call all of his locations and see if they were still available to go back to the exact locations and reshoot, too. And fortunately enough, most of them, if not all, except the scene in the desert scene in the Jordan, they couldn't get that location.
That's Kevin Spacey in the movie.
Yes, Kevin Spacey. And you can clearly see that was a green shot, a green screen shot when that was the reel of John Paul. Which is fun. It's distracting. I noticed it. But that was one of the only locations that they couldn't get. But everywhere else, they managed to get the original places.
Yeah, and when you talk about redlining, it's not just Ridley redlining. This thing literally went from shoot to then the edit bay right at like just seconds to having it done that night. Great, shoot, edit, all right. And by the time they film everything, all right, you're 90% there. Now, the interesting part is, yes, they're sort of, they didn't show Christopher Plummer any of what was there. They wanted him to take the role and let it be his role. Mm-hmm. So you're affecting pacing at this point because it's not like, okay, great, Kevin Spacey did this scene in 2 minutes, so we're going to shoot this for 2 minutes and we're going to just place it right in and everything fits. You have to retime music. Mm-hmm. You have to, the whole movie changes.
Yeah, and just the whole character changes too because actors have their own personality traits and quotes. And I think it was really smart because I believe Ridley Scott said that Christopher Plummer was more of a sympathetic type and cruel sometimes as a character, where Kevin Spacey was more colder and more emotionless, more stoic. And we're used to Kevin Spacey with his Ron Underwood character. That is kind of, so I think we probably would have had a hard distinction between Ron Underwood and John Paul Getty. But Christopher Plummer had his own personal take on it. And really liked it.
Well, when you talk about the effects of all of that, it's not just affecting that character. In those scenes, because Michelle Williams and Mark Wahlberg are, for the most part, I mean, there's other actors too, but they have to now change their performance based on how they're reacting to him. Mm-hmm. You know, because if the line was, get out, and I said, get out, you react differently than I say, get out!
Right, exactly.
Just based on that. And so that changed their performance. And the fact that, I mean, I'd have to really rewatch, but you know, the scenes where they didn't have to reshoot, the fact that they emotionally still track for Gail in particular and Fletcher, and it works, mm-hmm. is a huge testament to a lot of things.
Yeah. And, I mean, it kudos to all the actors coming back, despite if some were begrudgingly so. And we'll get into that, too. But I think it's great because fortunately, it didn't change the story. It just changed how we react to the story. And I think it was really smart. And fortunately, they did have the time and the locations to naturally get back into their physical characters. I like that. Also, with the refilming, because they knew they didn't have time to do ADR, while they were actually filming in locations, they had to get better mics and better actual sound mixers on set. So they had the perfect, clearest audio just in the reshoots, so they would put that in the actual film. There was no time for sound editing.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, I was like, what? They had to get better mics.
And, you know, that's always scary. The amount of ADR that actually goes into a movie is insane.
It's ridiculous. People don't know how much.
Like, they just basically might as well just shoot audio on, like, a shitty camera and with, like, the engine going off in the background, because it's... Yeah, production audio is the worst.
Mm-hmm. It is. And then the great thing about production, it's more for the visual aspects, and you know you can fix it in post. And that's what the line is, fix it in post.
Yeah, but ADR is always, like, it's a separate art of its own.
It is.
Because you're acting to yourself to mimic the same voice that you had, but just for the purpose of getting it cleaner. Yeah. And then as far as sound editing, since we're on it, then you take that very clean audio... And now you got to put it into a desert and make it sound like it's in a desert wherever.
Without Foley artists.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they had to get natural, the best, highest quality sound during the reshoots. And I think that's also an amazing testament to them.
Yeah. Because people don't realize how much sound actually goes into it. And by the way, when you talk about it's a good point about Foley... Because it's one thing, if you strip away the sound and you have your voice or my voice, you still got to have the movement of the shirt, let's say. And that's just like, you're like, wait, just the movement of the shirt? Yeah, you got a movement of the shirt. And then if I'm doing this.
Yeah, gesticulating.
Everything.
I gesticulate a lot, I know. And also people walk differently. People have different walking paces. Some people stomp, some people shuffle. It's a lot that people don't think when it comes to a person's performance and the sound that they can create.
Yeah. It's so much.
It's a lot.
It is so much. But yeah, to me, I was just really fascinated. And I don't think we'll ever get it. And I think it would be ultimately in poor taste to do it. But there is a curiosity side to me of, I would just love to see the Kevin Spacey cut.
I know.
It's not right. I get it. But
you're curious. I mean, yeah, it's unfortunate. Some of my favorite movies have Kevin Spacey in it. One of my all-time favorite movies has Kevin Spacey in it, and it's one of his best acting roles, I think, to date. And it's just really unfortunate that that can all be immediately tainted within 24 hours. But that doesn't change the fact that he's still talented and he's still an amazing actor, and he's done amazing crap in his life.
Well, here's how I would take it a step further. Whether American, American Beauty.
American Beauty, yeah.
Or whatever.
Pay for it.
Listen, at the end of the day, it's not just Kevin Spacey's movie, right? Mm-hmm. That movie in particular, a lot of great actors, great director, great screenwriter, a lot of people worked on that movie. So I get it. You don't want to support him. That's fine. But don't support the other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the way I try to look at it in terms of that regard.
Right. Support the art and the hard work and effort that went into it.
Now, as far as this is concerned, I'm glad they reacted the way they did and put their foot down. Because unlike American Graffiti can't go back and fix itself.
Yeah.
This didn't have to, but did. And then this is where we get into Trouble Part 2.
Yes.
So we go back to the reshoots. And here's Michelle Williams, already an amazing actress to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're actually going to be talking about another movie, The Greatest Showman,
yes,
with her in it. So this is a Michelle Williams type of day. But nonetheless, so check that out right after. But the point being... You know, her mindset is, I just want to make movies. All right, this is what we got to do. Let's do it. And furthermore, she's ecstatic because she's a woman, and okay, all these things are coming out, and you know, I don't want to, she says to herself, I don't want to stand by this, so absolutely, I'm meant to essentially save the movie.
Yeah, and I think that just is just shows the character and person she is when she even said, she's like, you can take my money, you can even take my Thanksgiving, because she had plans with her family. She's like, you can take my holiday, so long as this saves the film. She was in it for the art. She was in it for the passion of this film. And that's just the right mentality to have when you are in the trenches of how do we fix something such as big as this. And I think it was great that she was on board for it.
Then you get to the flip side. And this is Wahlberg, for the reshoots, he was going to be paid $1.5 million to do this. She, on the other hand, she got paid about $800 and per diem.
Per diem.
That's... No, I mean, you can call it what you want, but it's still $800 versus... No,
it was, yeah, it was like 800 in total. It was like less than 1,000 compared to Mark Wahlberg's $1.5 million.
Now, here's why I'm...
Egregious.
You know, here's why I might get in trouble, and I don't know fully... what the full story is, right? We'll never fully know. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I'd like to think that Wahlberg, A, maybe didn't know, and B, oftentimes it comes to agents really negotiating this. So I think it, in large part, I don't think Wahlberg necessarily had too much to do with it. I don't know. This is just pure speculation. And they kind of negotiated this number. Where the irony falls to me is that the people that are negotiating Wahlberg's payment are the same people that are also negotiating Williams' payment. Mm-hmm. So why in the hell you wouldn't negotiate for her to get higher payment, I don't understand. Now, why would I say that? Because the higher she earns, the more you fucking earn.
Yeah, it's true.
It's so be great. Like, listen, you don't have to be altruistic. You don't have to be a feminist. Be greedy. Earn yourself more fucking money.
Yeah, but that's also the thing. They shouldn't have to be greedy. They have all the money in the world.
Listen.
But also...
I'm just saying. You're not going to change people.
I get it.
But go with your natural intuition and mode of operation.
I get it. If one person is greedy, the other person should be greedy. It sounds terrible. We're unfortunately not looking like good people right now. But I understand that. But it's just unfortunate when it's the same people representing the same people, and one gets more than the other. That's wrong. That's just wrong.
And again, I get what you're saying, and I agree with it. Mm-hmm. And again, I know it's not the right thing, but in that sense, unfortunately, I can't force altruism onto people. But when most people say, hey, would you rather make $10 or... you know, let's say $500,000. And I'm just throwing out numbers. You'd say $500,000, right?
Right.
So it's like, listen, your natural gut is just going to kick in. You're going to want more fucking money.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
It's true. I think it's just unfortunate that this news even got out. Despite the fact that we had Spacey's allegations already kind of tainting this film, and they had to fix that. But now after this film has been redone, re-edited, and released with all the new changes, and then this information gets out after the fact, I mean, this movie can't catch a break. And I think it's just really unfortunate that news, which should be actually very private, got out for everybody to know.
Well, I'm not upset by the fact that it got out. I don't blame Ridley Scott for it. I doubt he had... You know, he's just like, all right, I'm so focused on reshooting this and getting my locations and figuring out the rest out.
Yeah, he's not caring how much his actors made. He's caring about the artwork of the film.
Yeah. So as far as this, I mean, this is where I go to you, because this is where I don't quite have an opinion. As far as now Wahlberg giving away what he got in the name of Michelle Williams towards the Me Too Fund, which is basically a legal nonprofit that will help women get equal pay in both this business and otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And WME is donating $500,000 as well, so for a total of $2 million.
Good. They should, because they're the ones who did this. I think, yeah, that's admirable. I don't think he would have done it if this information got out. I think he would have pocketed that money and used it for his other personal resources. But since this information got out, it's trying to like rebuild his image and his character. I think that was more of a public stunt than or publicity PR, rebuilding your image, than what he actually wanted. Because if he was just going to give this money away anyways, what's the point of just even rehaggling and renegotiating his salary if he was just going to give it away at the end? So giving it away and to the place he gave it away, good. But the reason why he gave it away, bad.
Fair enough. Yeah, that's where it's hard for me to have a stance on it. That's where my argument and my thinking just stops and breaks down.
Right, and it's really unfortunate. I've never really minded Mark Wahlberg. I think he's an okay actor. I never loved him or disliked him in that sense. But when this news got out, I'm like, he's not looking like the greatest guy right now.
I think he's much better in comedies, to be honest. Like, in this movie, I give him a B.
Yeah, I'd give him a C plus B minus.
Christopher Plummer, way better. Michelle Williams,
way
phenomenal.
Better. Yeah,
and you know, it's hard for me to say this is Michelle's greatest work, but that's because she's done so much other amazing work, yeah. And it's tough to rank that.
It is. I mean, just look at all the accomplishments that she has. Even like this time last year, she was in Manchester by the Sea in December 2016. This movie came out in December last year, 2017. So like a year ago, she was already getting nominated again for Best Supporting Actress. So you know she has the acting chops and wherewithal and recognition for this role. I think her character was so much better and so much stronger than Fletcher was, only because I think this isn't out of Mark Wahlberg's wheelhouse. He's known for being the kind of the authoritative person. He always has to stick it to the man when absolutely necessary, and it makes him look like he's the smartest guy in the room. We've seen that so often. And Mark's not going to get nominated for this role because there wasn't really acting.
No, and you're right. He does that, but to that same point, he does it generally in a comedic sense. Like, I was waiting for a punchline every time. No offense to him. And it was tough because part of it, I always looked at him as Mark Wahlberg, whereas, yes, Michelle Williams is very recognizable to me, but I never saw her as that. I saw her as Gail. Mark Wahlberg, I saw as Mark Wahlberg as Fletcher, not Fletcher.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that distinction, and it's tough to quantify where that line is, but that's what I felt. Yeah. I mean, it was tough.
Yeah, I think Mark Wahlberg plays the same characters a lot, over the same type of characters over and over again. He's good at it. That's why he keeps doing it.
I think literally stick to comedies. He was great in The Departed, but he had a comedic role in The Departed.
Yeah.
I thought he, you know, the other guys, and even Daddy's Home, that series. I think that's his wheelhouse.
Ted,
a good example. Absolutely.
I mean, but also I think one of the better dramatic roles that Wahlberg has had was The Fighter.
Yes, not to crap on your point, he benefited from amazing actors around him.
He did.
That elevated him. I mean, what Christian Bale did, what Amy Adams did. What was the mother's name? Her real name?
Oh, I'm completely forgetting because I'm only thinking of the actor. That sounds terrible. I keep thinking Melissa Leo because she was the actor.
Yes, Melissa. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Yes, Melissa Leo.
Yeah.
The actor's real name, not.
Not
the mom. She did. You know. So
amazing.
Like, think of all those people when you're like constantly acting around those people. Think of how high you have to get elevated to do so.
That's very true.
So you know he benefited greatly. No, I'm not saying he didn't do a good job in that movie. I'm just saying I think.
Like he was forced to be on the level of everybody else.
And plus, like if he wasn't. You know, if he wasn't necessarily the best, like it just kind of gets lost in the shuffle.
Mm-hmm.
And his role was a little bit more physical in that role.
Yeah.
Because he was, you know, he was the
boxer.
Actual
fighter.
Yeah. So it's a little bit, anyway, I don't mean to say he's a bad actor. I'm just saying.
No, no, no. We just know. He has some good roles. He has better roles.
Yeah.
So.
And so anyway. All right. Let's talk about the editing and the production side of things, I guess, the sound and the music. Well, I guess we did talk about the sound effects. As far as when it comes specifically to music, what was interesting to me was I thought it worked, but it wasn't necessarily the most memorable soundtrack.
No.
But it was suspenseful. I remember it being suspenseful. And I say that often, I feel like. But to that notion, I don't need my soundtracks to be memorable. I need them to work for the movie. And I thought the movie worked really well. And so, therefore, the sound worked. Just right. Like editing supposed to disappear into the background, not be in your face.
Right. And, I mean, and there are some movies where the soundtrack is fantastic. And we'll talk about that soon. I think the moment where I definitely remembered it was the whole when they're finally all at the end and they're trying to get John Paul Getty III and everyone finally meets and they're running around the street because there wasn't really a lot of dialogue. It was more this is the chase game.
Yeah.
That's where it really hit. And when they cut off his ear. Whew, painful to watch, painful to listen to.
Yes, they had a lot of that was a combination of visual, sound, and music.
Yeah.
So, absolutely. Let's talk promotion, because very interesting, right? A lot of promotion based on the severed ear. And, in fact, that's our background image today.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a decent choice in the context of if you're the head of marketing and get told, like, hey, all the marketing has to be pulled, the trailers have to be pulled, we have to redo it with Chris Plummer. And, by the way, you can't... We're filming that, so it's not like you can, like, create it.
Right. You need the actual images.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, what do we go with? Well, what do most people remember about that story, if they remember it? Because, granted, you're not marketing this to millennials. You're marketing it to a more sophisticated crowd, ergo older as well.
Yeah.
People who have probably lived through this, and so you show them the ear. It's like, we don't need anybody for this.
Mm-hmm. We only know about the ear. But also, for the promotions, I was reading a little bit about this as well, is that because they had such a short turnaround for just promotional aspects, they had to use different pictures for their posters. Now, when you actually, you know, Google search images and poster images, you see only Mark Wahlberg and Michelle Williams. You see statues, not of Kevin Spacey. You see, like, objects and the other people that were in this film besides Kevin Spacey. You had to show something else other than the main character, which is unfortunate.
And then they
finally, but that's what they had to work with.
Then they finally, towards the end, because I remember before the movie actually came out, they finally were able to get a poster with all three and in big letters, Christopher Plummer.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that worked really well, and I really liked that poster, and I saw it. A lot.
Yeah.
So, very, very, you know, they made it work. And when you talk, like, this movie was always going to be an Oscar contender. It was always going to be in contention for Golden Globes. Like, that was their plan. Now, whether or not it wins, whether or not so forth, you know, as awards season goes on, remains to be seen. But nonetheless, now not only have to change that, you have to change your marketing campaign towards the award shows.
Yeah. And, but that also affects the technical award nominations that you could get, like sound editing, sound writing, or like sound mixing, even acting. Because if you wanted Kevin Spacey up for an Academy Award, now it has to be Christopher Plummer. And it changes a lot of aspects of this film. Just about everything changed. The story changed, or the story remained the same, but everything else changed around it.
Yeah, for a long time, I thought he was going to be in the movie for like 10 minutes. Now, he's not the main character, but he's in the movie quite a lot. And
yes.
He is getting a lot of recognition. For 10 days worth of work, he's getting a lot of recognition. And good for him. I hope he gets something down the line.
Oh, yeah. Definitely a nomination, at least. I don't think it was over the top, like, oh my god, that's the best role I've ever seen Christopher Plummer do. But I think just what they had accomplished in such short amount of time needs some recognition of some sense.
Yeah, and even without that short amount of time, I thought he did an amazing job. He really did. And by the way, if you want to see more Christopher Plummer, check out The Man Who Invented Christmas.
Yes.
He's in that as Ebenezer Scrooge. And I thought it quite a good movie.
He was excellent in that film. And also just good timing for Christopher Plummer, too, to have now two movies out in theaters at the same time. Like Michelle Williams.
88 years old. 88!
I mean, he's amazing.
That would be a nice culmination to his work of if he was able to get some, and I'm not saying it has to be even a SAG award, and I'm not saying it has to be an Oscar, but there's plenty of acting accolades mm-hmm. that he could still get.
Yeah, agreed.
So I'm all for it. And also Michelle Williams, I want her to get some recognition. Obviously she was nominated for a Golden Globe, so we're kind of skipping around, but Golden Globes is in our history.
Yes.
In our future are the SAGs, are the Oscars. And all the other technical award shows and so forth. But nominated were Ridley Scott, Christopher Plummer, and Michelle Williams.
And I'm glad that they did. And you see how Mark Wahlberg's not on that? Because he doesn't deserve to be there.
There's just so many other better supporting
exactly.
characters. So... Anywho, as far
unfortunately, they didn't win, but they're already in lines for and in talks for SAG and Academy Awards. Yeah. It places them in a good position.
It does indeed. As far as the box office is concerned, right now, worldwide, they've made about $36 million against a budget of $50 million. For a movie like this, that's award season movies have longevity. Mm-hmm. There's not going to be a lot of things coming out. And so I'm sure that number will continue to grow as things go by and as momentum picks up for it and be like, oh, I got to check out this Oscar contender. I got to check out this.
Right. And this is fortunately, back in the 70s. So it is now a timeless story. And you can watch this any time of the year. Is it rewatchable, though? I don't know. Compared to other Academy Award winning pictures that are rewatchable. I'm not sure if this one is.
Well, that begs the debate of how do you define rewatchability? There's a lot of movies that it's kind of that weird irony. The greatest movies aren't the ones you generally go back to.
Right.
You see them once and you're like, that was amazing, but
never again.
Yeah. It's interesting that way. Like The Artist. That one, right?
Yeah, that one.
I don't think I'll ever see The Artist again.
I liked The Artist. The Artist was good. I've only seen it once, though. I agree with that.
Revenant. I've been lucky enough to see The Revenant twice. Not a movie that I probably would have if I wasn't like, hey, come watch this, Marissa. Right.
Schindler's List. Yeah, I mean, we could keep going.
Yes, anyway. We digress. Overall, Rotten Tomatoes right now a score of 77% against 171 reviews. As it reads, all the money in the world offers an absorbing portrayal of a true story brought compellingly to life by a powerful performance from Christopher Plummer. It's got a cinema score of B, so not too bad.
No, and I did generally enjoy this film because I learned a lot from it and just the story. And I've said it in multiple Anatomy shows that I like movies that tell me a story that I didn't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
more people should.
I am actually very fascinated by the Getty history, and I want to learn more. I don't know too in-depth, truthfully, so unfortunately I can't present it
go
today.
To the museum.
Well, I think that's one aspect of it, certainly. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting. You kind of learn that way of what he was interested in, but it doesn't fully... Like he was an oil tycoon. It's not like let me put it this way. It's different than going to a Van Gogh museum because that is his work and you get to see, this is like an extension of him.
Yeah.
It's John Getty third degree.
Yes. I understand that too. It's actually a really cool place if you're actually ever in Los Angeles. Yeah, I say stop by the Getty Museum. It's really cool of all the artwork and the sculptures and everything he, well, not really everything, but most of his collection that are now in glass cases. You can just tell his somewhat of his personality and the things that he was interested in and what he thought was beautiful. Very interesting.
Well, there you go. Any final thoughts before we wrap this up?
I hope more people see this film because I think, unfortunately, it's one of those films that so much work has been put into it and not a lot of people will see it. And I think more people should see it.
Yeah, I would agree. I would encourage people to see it. I think it's a, you know, slice of life, a horrific slice of life,
yeah.
Slice of a near.
Yeah.
As well. But nonetheless, I think, you know, that history and that side of things exist in our world. And I don't mind escapist movies or art, but I also don't shy away from stories such as this.
Yeah.
Is all I'll have to say on that. Anywho, that's all we got for you today. Coming up, Anatomies, we'll be doing Greatest Showman. We'll do Molly's Game next week. We'll do, and for a little bit more lighthearted fun, we'll do Paddington 2.
Yes.
And we'll continue to, as we go through this, do a mix of more fun movies, let's say, versus the Oscar contenders. And by the time the Oscars come, we'll ideally, hopefully, fingers crossed, get through every single movie mm-hmm. that is on that list. So, anyway, keep checking back in. Also, we encourage you guys to go through our library. We've covered a lot of movies.
A lot.
They're all there for you to browse through. So, if you know, if years from now you see a movie, whether it be, I don't know, Star Wars: The Last Jedi, come back, check us out.
There we go. And we've covered a lot of Wahlberg movies, a lot of Michelle Williams movies.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, check
Ridley's
that.
Movies. Yes. There's a lot.
We covered Alien Covenant, yes.
We have.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you guys as always at Serafini TV.
That's right.
At DMovies1701 for Dimitri, who is not here, but hey, he will happily tweet back at you.
Yes.
And also, I'm at Phil Svitek, and of course, at The Popcorn Talk here. And if you want, for a little bit of support, follow at Movie Anatomy.
Yes.
At Movie Anatomy, yes. So until next time, guys, keep watching movies.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.